colleagues, it's an honor, privilege and unique chance to share table with the British Foreign Minister Jack Straw. This is a regular meeting of all the Czech ambassadors, heads of missions of the Czech Republic, and everybody is keen to listen to you, Jack Straw, and to speak with you. So welcome, and I wish you a nice stay in the Czech Republic, and in that very informal way, I am giving you a floor, and welcome again, and we wish you a nice stay. Fine. You can start.
Thank you very much.
Minister, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dobry den. I'm afraid that's about it when it comes to conducting our meetings in Czech rather than your meetings in English, but I'll explain where I learnt that and a few other words in a moment. I'd like to thank you, Cyril, very much indeed for inviting me to come to this conference of ambassadors, and I feel honoured to be here. In 1641, our Parliament, then the English Parliament, which was otherwise limbering up for what became our Civil War, invited the great Moravian scholar and educationalist, Comenius, to England to offer his advice. John Milton was so enthusiastic at Comenius's arrival that he called him a person sent hither by some good providence from a far country, the occasion and incitement of great good to this island. I think it's fair to say that great good has flown between our island and your great country ever since, and we have benefited hugely from the relationship. And that story illustrates that the relationship between your land and ours has long enriched both our countries. We remember with pride the part which the Czech and the British forces played together in the fight against Nazism. I said I'd explain my two words of Czech and where I learnt them. The Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia, as it then was the very first foreign country in which I ever stayed. I came here in 1962, and I liked it so much I came again in 1963, camping. And we camped in and around Prague. We camped in the White Mountains. But one of the things I can still remember as if it was yesterday was a visit which we all went on in 1962 to Lidice. And I was born just after the war, so I was aware of what the war had done for the United Kingdom and the physical marks of it. But we never had foreign troops on our soil. You did. And what Lidice brought home to me was that even in a world war, there are levels, gradations of brutality and degradation. We in the United Kingdom suffered, but we were lucky. You suffered, and you were unlucky, and I've never, ever forgotten that. Today, our armed forces are serving together again, with great distinction in the Balkans, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq. Our bilateral trade is worth more than £2 billion a year. And where Comenius once came to sort out our universities, the Czech architect, Eva Jirinča, is that how you pronounce it? Jirinča. Is now masterminding the redevelopment of London's Victoria and Albert Museum and has also designed the new British Council here in Prague. And the Czech ballerina, Daria Klementova, is starring at the English National Ballet. I should also say that, of course, you've long had a Czech in the British Parliament. My very good friend, Alf Dubs, sounds like an English name, but both his parents were Czech. He went into Parliament the same year as me, in 1979. He was rather less lucky with the vagaries of the electorate than so far. I have been, but he's now in that wonderful place in the British Parliament where there are no elections, called the House of Lords. I recommend this. It's a great consolation for those of us of a certain age in British politics. But I say that many connections. I often, Alf, say, who I know very well, if you saw him, you'd think he was English, then you listen very, very closely, and you can hear that tang of Czech just somewhere at the back of his throat. But he's literally Czech in our parliament. We both benefit greatly from the strong relationship, which is why the British government has ensured that our labour market was laid open to legitimate workers from the Czech Republic immediately after accession on the 1st of May of this year. And I may say I'm very grateful to the Czech government and to your ambassador, Cyril, particularly around Europe and especially your ambassador in the United Kingdom, for all the work that you did to try and allay the fears, many of which were being whipped up quite ruthlessly by one or two newspapers, about how this would lead to a flood. The fact that there's scarcely been a single story about this since we started producing the facts in place of the myths illustrates how smoothly this has gone and how we have benefited. We hoped it would benefit people in the Czech Republic, but let us be clear, this was not an act of charity. We thought that our society and our labour market would benefit, and so it has. This new relationship within the European Union is obviously strengthening our relationship further, and it gives us both a strong interest in the EU's future direction, which is a theme on which I wish to focus my remarks today. Only 4 months into this historic enlargement, the shape of the new European Union's priorities, its alliances and politics, is bound to take some time before it fully becomes clear. But we already know that the European Union of 25 members will be different in nature from that of an EU at 15. The new member states, such as the Czech Republic, are bringing new perspectives and new ideas, fresh and successful experience of economic transformation, insight and understanding of the EU's new neighbours to the east, and a skilled and creative generation of young people, as we're discovering through Britain's Crossroads for Ideas campaign. And the new constitutional treaty, which we agreed just 4 months, 3 months ago in June, will change the way in which the European Union does its business. And the pressure of a globalised and interdependent world is forcing the EU to adapt to face new challenges. Maintaining our economic power in the face of global competition and improving our capacity to face today's security threats. In all these areas, change is already underway, but we need to ensure that we build on this and shape this change in the right direction for the future. The fact that things are changing is reflected in the way in which we talk about the European Union itself. We used to hear a lot about what was known in the jargon as finality, a fixed end state at which the European Union was aimed, usually consisting for its advocates of a federally structured organisation, a superstate. The idea of such a fixed destination lies behind the metaphors of fast and slow lanes, of forging ahead or being left behind, or of a two-speed or multi-speed Europe. And though these views are diametrically opposed to the ones at the other end of the spectrum, the die-hard opponents of further integration relied on a similarly fixed idea of the EU's finality. For them, it is a case of thus far and no further. But both views, in my view, are mistaken, because it is wrong to fix the nature of the European Union in stone. The world is continually changing, perhaps faster now than ever before, and the European Union has to change and be able to change if it is to survive and prosper with that world change. A recognition of this explains why the idea of finality has long had its day. And the drafters and negotiators of the new constitutional treaty were acutely conscious of that. The final text which we agreed sets out a framework which is not that of a federal and rigid European Union, but of a more flexible, multidimensional and adaptable organisation. There obviously must always be common rules which apply to all across the European Union. Such rules are the foundation of the single market, ensuring fair treatment for people and businesses across Europe. And those of us, the Czech Republic and United Kingdom for two, which seek to play by the rules, benefit from their strict enforcement and even enforcement across the European Union. But the EU is also becoming a framework for smaller groups of nations to cooperate more closely, when they so choose, without obliging everyone else to join in. The euro is one example. Another is the creation of a European crisis management capability, in which Britain is playing a leading role. Under the new constitution, such cooperation will be better defined than before, and there will be stronger provisions to ensure that it operates in a way which is fair to every member. And that's very welcome. Now, I think it's important that we don't mistake this kind of flexibility for what is sometimes, and usually with a sneer, referred to as Europe à la carte. It is rather proof of the EU's capacity to adapt its constitutional arrangements to changing demands and circumstances. And that's something with which the British, from our own constitutional history, can identify. And in a sense, a more flexible Europe builds on the traditions of the past, does not break with them. One of the European Union's great strengths has always been its capacity to act as an enabler, releasing the potential of its citizens and of its member states. The customs union in the 1960s and the single market in the 1980s broke down barriers to trade to give Europe's businesses greater opportunity and Europe's consumers greater choice. The right to live, to work or to do business across the continent without obstacles which the EU has given its citizens has unleashed greater benefits still. British television is full of programmes on people setting up businesses in Italy or moving home to Spain, benefits of our EU membership which we often take for granted. And indeed, it's always been slightly ironical to me that some of the most Eurosceptic people in the United Kingdom are only too happy to get their cheap flight to Spain and then to continue to pontificate about the state of Europe from the house which they have bought in Spain, living on the social security benefits which they draw from the United Kingdom but are paid out in Spain. All benefits which derive directly from membership of the European Union, and none of which would either be there at all or there with that felicity were we not members of the European Union. And 500,000 Britons live in Spain alone. And I may say too, that was another scare. When Spain was about to come into the European Union, it was said that hundreds and thousands of Spanish and Portuguese would flee from Spain and Portugal to the United Kingdom. Those who claimed this forgot about the comparison between the British weather and the Spanish and the Portuguese weather. And the simple fact of the matter is that some Spanish and Portuguese have come to the United Kingdom and they're very welcome indeed, but the flow has been overwhelmingly the other way, and who can blame our compatriots? And altogether, 15 million Europeans now live or work in another European country other than their own. Great, because this is a Europe genuinely without borders, the kind of vision of a Europe that many of us have had for a very long time. Because the other thing I remember very acutely about coming to Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic, as it then was. Two things, both related. One was talking to young people here, my age, and them grieving about the absence of liberty. And the second was the Iron Curtain, that border between where our coach went through, between the Czech border and Germany. Unpleasant it was. It's extraordinary how things have moved on for the better in the intervening period. The EU has laid the foundations of fairness and freedom, which enables people to enjoy all these benefits right across the continent. And the same capacity to release potential through fair common rules lies behind the arrangements for more flexible cooperation between the EU's member states today. The rules ensure that such cooperation is fair, it's exclusive, and not imposed on anyone. But within that framework, these rules allow the EU's member states to exploit the potential of greater cooperation where they want to do so. If the EU's greater flexibility responds to the need to adapt to a changing world, it cannot simply be limited to new areas of cooperation, but must also apply, where appropriate, to the EU's existing powers. Again, the new treaty will give the Union that capacity by allowing for powers which in the past have been exercised by the EU to be repatriated to individual members when it is more efficient or effective to do so. An important part, I think it was Article 111 in the, or 110 in the old numbering of the new treaty, and it's one which we should make use of. Of course, the new treaty has yet to be ratified and implemented, and in Britain and the Czech Republic, amongst others, that will be a decision taken by the people themselves in a referendum, as your newspaper headlines are reminding us this morning. But those of us, I can read that bit in Czech, those of us like me who will be campaigning for a yes vote will continue to stress that the kind of European Union which it sets out is one in which all Europe's nations can be comfortable, a modern and effective organisation which is able to conduct its business more efficiently and flexible enough to adapt to that changing world. Let me turn out now to the second change which is underway in Europe, the transformation of the European Union into an organisation with a global role. There are two aspects to that, economic and political, both of which centre on the question of the role which the EU should play in the world of the future. The EU can be proud of having created the biggest common market in the world. There is still some unfinished business, for example on the liberalisation of services, but the achievement to date is clear. According to the European Commission, the single market has brought 2.5 million new jobs and more than €800 billion in extra wealth. National telephone calls in the EU cost half what they did just 6 years ago. European promotional airfares in 2000 were 40% lower than they were in 1992. But global competition is setting in the European Union serious challenges, in addition to those posed within our own borders. In the open global economy, companies will buy their products and services, invest their money, and employ their people where it is most competitive to do so. We have to ensure that it is in Europe that this is so, by creating the right conditions to attract lasting investment. And if I may say so, the Czech Republic's excellent record shows what can be achieved. And if we want to maintain and increase Europe's global economic standing, and with it our power and influence in the world, we have to boost economic growth in the European Union. You know, it takes the United States economy growing at a trend rate of 3%, just 7 months to add to the United States GDP the total of Poland's GDP. It's an extraordinary fact which puts into perspective relative economic power. Within the next decade, China is likely to overtake Germany as the world's third largest economy, with India not so far behind. Indeed, if you look at the figures, not on exchange rates but purchasing power parities, China and India are already way into the top five. And Europe has to reform if it's to meet these challenges. We have to create more flexible and liberal labour, product and capital markets. We have to increase employment, because having a job is the best form of social protection there is. And I'm delighted that Czech and British experts are exchanging best practice in this area. And we have, those of us, if I may make a party point, Cyril, and I fully understand that Czech diplomats are in a very similar position to British diplomats, but speak from a party point of view, of the British Labour Party. When I, 40 years ago, when I just joined the Labour Party, the idea of a Labour politician talking easily about a liberal labour market was anathema. Indeed, it was beyond imagination. Mm-hmm. But of course, we spoke about unemployment. And then we went through some serious trauma of very high unemployment, not least in the 1970s and the 1980s. And the reason why we talk about liberal, not unregulated, but liberal labour laws in the United Kingdom is because they are one part of a coherent economic strategy which has reduced unemployment from one of the worst levels in Europe to one of the best, and by far the best in terms of large countries, mm-hmm. and also shifted our position in terms of overall prosperity from, again, one of the worst positions in Europe to one of the best. And the nature of labour markets, so far as I'm concerned, is a means to an end. Because I've been in the British Parliament now for 25 years. I saw the greatest inequality of all in the eyes and in the pinched households, at the eyes of people who are unemployed and their pinched households, as unemployment rose to getting off of 20% of males in my constituency in the early 1980s. And one of the great things we've done, again, and long may it continue, is almost, not quite, to remove that scourge of unemployment, one of the things which I thought I and my grandparents never thought we would see as socialists. We've also got to spend more on research and development. We need to ensure that European regulation is a help, not a hindrance to business, which means lifting outdated measures and subjecting new proposals to rigorous assessment to ensure that they really do enhance our competitiveness. In the United Kingdom, I began an exercise 18 months ago to ensure that our government and parliament transpose European directives into British law more simply and without so-called gold plating. The four presidencies of Ireland, Netherlands, Luxembourg and the United Kingdom have committed themselves to a major focus on better regulation. And all this is welcome, as is the wider recognition that a more acute balance on regulation has to be achieved. But this is only part of the battle. The bigger problem arises from directives and regulations made inside the European Union many years ago and which have been much embroidered since by EU Commission practice and court judgments and which are still in force. And I therefore welcome the efforts which were being made by the outgoing Commission, I hope will be pushed even more by the new Commission, to start going through, I think, 80,000 pages of acquis to see what is redundant, what could be removed. And I hope very much that once the Constitutional Treaty comes into force, the parliaments, national parliaments of all the member states, will really make use of their provisions under the subsidiarity protocol, because they're provisions with teeth for the first time, and that provision which enables competences to be handed back, to ensure that we act as a countervailing pressure to those within the Commission administration who quite naturally see it as part of their life's work and the product of what they do to produce more regulations or to administer still more strictly the existing ones. Their purpose and our purpose is to see the European Union as a flexible instrument to make our peoples more prosperous and more secure. And everything else has to be subordinate to that. The challenge of economic reform is therefore going to be a priority for the new Commission under the leadership of José Manuel Barroso. I'm delighted that the Commission is getting off to such a dynamic start. And I'm delighted, too, that Vladimir Spidler, as the new Czech Commissioner, will be part of that new team with one of the most crucial portfolios. I look forward to discussing the challenges of economic reform with him when I meet him later on today. The second reason why Europe must now turn its focus to the challenges outside our borders concerns our collective security. Like those to our economic power and prosperity, today's threats to our security come primarily from outside the EU's borders: terrorism, proliferation, conflict, state failure, and international crime. We are getting better at tackling them. The EU has intervened successfully in Macedonia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and is preparing to take over peacekeeping duties from NATO in Bosnia with an EU-led force under British leadership. I was in the Sudan last Monday and Tuesday, and although the EU's presence is more in the background than the foreground. I have to say that in my involvement with the Sudanese government, it helped me hugely to know that in what I was doing, I had the support of all other EU colleagues, and that the government of the Sudan had to have a care, not only to our reaction to how they were dealing with Resolution 1556, or to that of France and the other two current EU members of the Security Council, but also to the whole of the 25. And our work in implementing the EU security strategy is helping to bring together all the instruments at the EU's disposal, whether aid, expertise, or military force where necessary, and diplomacy in a joined-up way to pursue our security interests. But we need to get better still, because working together more closely on security makes sense. Together, the European Union accounts for a quarter of world GDP, a third of world trade, 50% of the UN budget, and 55% of global development aid, giving us far greater clout in the world where we agree to act together than any of us would have alone. But if we're going to do this, we've got first to increase our capacity for crisis management and our cooperation on so-called hard security issues, such as terrorism and the proliferation of WMD. We've got to make sure our forces are more capable. George Robertson, the former Secretary General of NATO, often drew attention to the fact that whilst there were, I think, 1.5 million or more men and women under arms within the European Union, there are only 55,000 available for combat duty at any one time, which is ridiculous. I mean, and poses the question, what conceivable value for money are the publics of those countries, particularly where they've got forces simply polishing old missiles and walking around parade grounds, are going to do what they're there for in today's world. We can build on the establishment of the European Defence Agency last month, a welcome step towards addressing the gaps in the EU's military capabilities. We can applaud the appointment of the European Counter-Terrorism Coordinator and on the agreement of an EU action plan on weapons of mass destruction. We also have to be more effective at promoting universal values of liberal democracy, human rights and tolerance for which Europe stands. 6 years after I first came to Czechoslovakia, I remember as a student leader organising demonstrations of solidarity with those in this city who stood up to repression in 1968. You won that fight 21 years later in 1989. And the values of freedom, tolerance and democracy still have a special resonance here. There would be no better signal of Europe's wish to support the spread of those universal values than a positive decision to open accession negotiations with Turkey this December. The last crucial ingredient for an effective global European role will be a stronger relationship with the United States. As the American historian William Hitchcock has observed in The Struggle for Europe, the great achievement of the post-war international order has been built through transatlantic cooperation, the UN, NATO, the World Bank and the IMF, the containment and defeat of communism and the massive expansion of humanitarian aid and relief. Yet, as Hitchcock continues, other frontiers beckon. The challenge of global poverty, of disease, weapons proliferation, religious fundamentalism, terrorism and failed states. As Hitchcock suggests, Europe and the United States can only tackle these problems effectively by working together. And our task over the coming years must be to build a shared agenda with the US where we can address the whole range of issues, from terrorism and proliferation to poverty to environmental degradation, climate change and disease, which create the conditions in which threats to our security and prosperity can thrive. Cyril, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I began with the importance of the relationship between Britain and the Czech Republic, and I want to end on the same theme. We may not agree on every detail about the EU's future direction, but we do share a very clear and common approach. We both take a pragmatic view of the world based on a desire to get concrete results. We both recognise the importance of creating the conditions for economic dynamism and for investing in research and innovation. And we both know that our security depends on being active around the world and on that strong relationship between the United States and Europe. Together, we can play an even more important part in shaping the changes which are defining the new European Union of 25 members, building a Europe which is outward-looking, adapting to challenges of reform, tackling today's security threats, is in our interests and those of every one of our partners. And by doing so, we can help to ensure that the EU, which has been so successful in the past, builds further on that success in the years ahead. Thank you very much indeed.